Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I am Danny LaRue, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. The Warriors are NBA champions again, winning Game 5 and the series 129-120 over the Cleveland Cavaliers. Kevin Durant is Finals MVP. He had a big 39 points, 14-20 from the field, 6-6 from the line. Lots of different things to discuss with this team, with this game. And the one person I wanted to talk with and was fortunately willing, he was a champion, we stayed up, started recording at about a little after 2:15 a.m., is Adam Lauritsen. Adam Lauritsen of the Fast Break blog, one of my favorite people to talk to about this team and somebody who did a great job of putting this in perspective. We went in a lot of different directions, ended up talking a little bit about the future because that's something he and I like talking about. Conversation runs about 40 minutes, and as many of you know, this is my last episode actually doing Locked On Warriors. So afterwards, for those of you who want to listen to it, I'm going to talk a little bit. So conversation is 39 minutes. I haven't recorded the second part yet, but it'll be after that. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly a big night. Warriors winning their second championship in 3 years, 16-1, which I feel like that doesn't have nearly the sex appeal of 16-0, but that I guess you could say that gives them something to look forward to for next year. But there are a lot of different ways to go with this, and what was your biggest takeaway from this massive night?
I don't even know where to start at this point. I guess my biggest takeaway is I'm still a bit in shock that this lowly Warriors franchise that I've been a fan of for so many years has now won 2 championships in 3 years and just won this championship with a tie for the best ever postseason performance. If you want to count, 16-1 rather than 15-1, I guess it was the best postseason performance ever. They are a team that we expected to be dominant, and I think that they lived up to those expectations, if not exceeding them a bit. It was the type of performance that we expected and hoped to see from Durant, really putting his stamp on this series at the end. And Curry, while he didn't win MVP, I think knocked down any doubt that he was a big-time performer and could have a dominant finals performance. He had a nice final game and a very solid performance throughout the finals.
I think those are both very fair points. The biggest one for me, maybe because I have made a cottage industry on Locked On Warriors of criticizing Kerr for this, was that he went small for a lot of this game. Other than Pachulia's about 10 minutes, I think it was 6 at the beginning of the first, 4 at the beginning of the third when he picked up 3 fouls in 38 seconds. But what was just big was that they leaned heavily on their best players, and they delivered by and large.
Yeah, it wasn't just going small. That, as you mentioned, was significant given the way that Kerr's played his rotations in the past. It was that they really just kind of made it simple, like they've been preaching on offense throughout the playoffs. Curry and Durant were both dominant with the ball in their hands. Curry was attacking the basket, got to the line 15 times tonight, which is incredible. Did that through just hard, fearless work of plunging into the middle and taking contact. And Durant was just pulling up from everywhere in isolation. As soon as he had a big man on him and could get some space, he was pulling up. If he had a smaller guy on him, he was driving in, getting into his mid-range game. He was just controlling the floor. And the interplay between those two, I think, was so impressive. It's one thing for a team to have a single dominant ball handler like LeBron towards the end of the game, who just bullied his way into baskets. But to have two players like that who can have the ball in their hands and create so much, but then trade off with each other was really special.
Something that was striking in this game, and I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, it harkened back to game 2, was that whenever the Warriors needed a bucket, it seemed like Kevin Durant was there.
Absolutely. He was the safety net throughout much of the series, throughout much of the playoffs. When the Warriors were really in a bind, Durant would find a way to get them points. That's what they wanted. He was the cheat code for when they ran into trouble this year. They didn't have him last year in the playoffs, and his presence made a huge difference.
And I thought one of the major developments of this game, and we might never have the answer, maybe Kerr will answer it in exit interviews or something else, is whether Durant's early foul trouble was what led to him playing with the second unit. But I thought that was a major part of this game, was that, you know, Cleveland did have that, they had a 4-point lead, partially due to a ridiculous J.R. Smith three at the end of the first quarter. But I was sitting there going, things went really, really well for them. They did not go that well for the Warriors. The officiating was uneven, let's call it, in the first quarter. And, but what that set up was, it set up Durant playing with the second unit, and the definitive stretch of this game was not that second unit. It was shortly thereafter, but Durant really fit in there, and then that also set up the fourth quarter.
Yeah, Draymond made a joke about it in the post game where he said, you know, this team has been really adaptable. Steve Kerr can roll out a brand new rotation in the fifth game of the NBA Finals, and the players just roll with it. And while I don't think it was Kerr's choice to do that, it was forced on him by foul trouble. The players really did respond well. The team that or the lineup that I thought was fascinating in the second quarter that helped start the run, although they weren't on the floor for the bulk of it, was basically as big a lineup as you'll see the Warriors go with. Curry wasn't on the floor. It was Iguodala, Thompson, Durant, Green, and West. And frontline and perimeter defense just all over the place, really scrambled the Cavs for a bit and seemed to get the Warriors back into the game in terms of the intensity that they needed.
Yeah, that was a really fascinating lineup. They only played a couple minutes together, but they were plus six. And it was another one that helped swing the dynamic. And then that led straight into the lineup and the run that really crystallized the championship, which was the 22-2 push right after Steph Curry came back in the game. Curry came in, David West stayed in, and so they went with Curry, Klay Thompson, Durant, Draymond, and West, I think, for most of that run. I think there was a little bit of interplay at various moments. And when you have a 22-2 run, both parts of that matter. The 22 was huge. The Warriors, my math had it that they scored on 13 consecutive trips down the floor. That doesn't mean shots or anything like that. There were a couple where they missed a shot and got a rebound or something like that. But the two is really important as well, because Cleveland, some of that was them kind of fumbling opportunities they usually maximize, but the Warriors were able to get that, to use a word that I overuse, a term I overuse, feedback loops. They were able to use good defense to set up good offense and good offense to set up their half-court defense.
It also was an answer to what the Cavs had done so well in game four. The Cavs had been the aggressor. They had been the ones to knock the Warriors back on their heels. All of the talk in the last 72 hours or whatever it's been since game four was, can the Warriors match the aggressiveness of the Cavs? And that lineup didn't just match the aggressiveness, it blew the doors off that Cavs lineup for aggressiveness. I mean, David West was swinging at everybody by the end of it. He had been so aggressive and got a technical, but I think it was well worth the price of admission for the Warriors to get that amped up and be that physically engaged in the game.
Well, especially because his technical led to two Cleveland technicals, so the Warriors actually came out of it with an extra free throw.
Yeah, exactly. It was the same story as in game four. The more aggressive team benefited from it. It wasn't the initial aggressor, who was West, who really suffered the brunt of it. It was the Cavs sort of pushing back who ended up with more of the calls.
And this is not necessarily the right tie-in, considering he was not the lead aggressor. But one of the other big takeaways for me of this game was that not only did Ian Clark get a DNP CD, he didn't play at all. Patrick McCaw played, and other than a rough stretch in, I think it was the second quarter when he missed two open threes, he played very well.
He had the six most minutes on the team, which may not sound like a big deal, but when you consider, four of those players who had minutes are NBA All-Stars. The fifth is Andre Iguodala, and the next man up is a second-round rookie named Patrick McCaw. That's pretty special. And like you said, he held himself well throughout the game. He missed a couple threes. He got cooked a couple times by Kyrie on the perimeter, but he kept coming back. And in the second half, he was there around the ball, giving them second chance opportunities, having some nice putbacks, really doing the dirty work and the types of things that we've seen from him all season, where he's just in the right place at the right time. He has a nose for the ball.
Yeah, you brought up the putback. That was his offensive rebound in the third quarter. It was on this strange play where he biffed a layup, and then I think it was Draymond tipped it. He got it back and threw it up in the same motion. But he also had a nice offensive rebound in the second quarter, which was basically a feel play. He wasn't involved in the primary action. I think he just saw where the ball was going and just zipped over there and got it and got the Warriors another chance. And plays like that are what can give him life in this league, even on a really good team that doesn't have that many minutes to spare.
Yeah, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because I want to have us enjoy the championship that this team just won. But we may have seen a bit of the future tonight where Patrick McCaw is a major minute rotation player. He's one of another long, versatile, aggressive piece that you can put on the floor that really creates matchup problems for other teams. He fits perfectly with the rest of the Warriors, and I think he's going to be a really nice piece going forward.
Speaking of versatile pieces that challenge the other team, I think we should talk a little bit more about Durant. Durant finished the series scoring 30 or more points in all five games. I heard a stat on my drive home that he was like the sixth player in recent, like I think since like the 60s to do that, which is absolutely incredible. For the record, LeBron got really close. He had 29 and 28 in games one and two. So if those had been even a little closer, maybe he would have gotten it. And Durant was awesome. I mean, he was doing that. He also shouldered a heavy load defensively. At moments, he had to handle foul trouble. I thought he was a little bit loose with the ball early in this game, but other than that, he was great.
Yeah, I agree that he was a little loose early, but when the Warriors really locked in, when they got their defensive intensity up, he was great from that point out. He had 39 points on 14 made field goals. He was 14 for 20 from the field, 5 for 8 from 3. Just shocking efficiency. We've gotten so used to seeing it from him that it doesn't shock us as much as it should. But you just compare it to sort of what Cleveland was doing. You know, LeBron had 41 points, so two more points. He took 10 more field goals to get it. The numbers and the way that Durant's able to play within the Warriors system and still be this effective offensively is really shocking. And he's only going to get better. They're only going to become tighter playing with each other. This was still the learning curve season, so I can't wait to see what they do next year.
It's hard to draw a direct analogy from this team to any of the other kind of super teamy squads that we've seen recently, like the 2011 Heat, because there was so much continuity outside of Durant. But you think back that other than the Celtics, those teams needed a little bit of time to figure it out. And that the Celtics were remarkable in their own way. And the Warriors on that part of this equation, I think they'll be better next year. You know, age is another question. Health is another question. But Durant, part of what impressed me so much for him in this game was these were not his easiest shots. I mean, some of them were well done, but this wasn't game one where he's just getting a lane to the basket every time. He was shooting pull-up threes in guys' faces. He was getting some of those mid-range shots that he can work his way to, usually on the left side of the floor. And they were better looks by and large than some of the ones that Kyrie was taking and making, because Kyrie is absolutely amazing. But he was able to pull that off, and it wasn't necessarily coming from the free throw line, because Curry had 15 attempts, as we talked about earlier. He had more attempts than the rest of the Warriors combined.
Yeah, the way that Durant is beginning to read the space that the Warriors create for him, I think, is really impressive. And I don't know whether I saw it more in the finals just because he was more of a focal point in the finals, or whether the Warriors are just getting better at it. But he has a way of repeatedly sort of finding his way into open space and then creating in it. And it uses his ball handling, his size, his mismatch ability so well. And I think when the Warriors become more natural in that, when it's not just Curry or Draymond who kind of senses that, or Iguodala, but the entire team, he's only going to become more dangerous.
And we also, at moments, not necessarily as much in this game as in some of the other ones, we saw the signs of what his defensive ceiling can be and really where this team can go, that he also buys Draymond some flexibility. The Warriors actually only allowed 111 points when Durant was per 100 when Durant was on the floor, which was the best of any of the starting five. But, you know, some of that was just that they had some awkward moments at various times when other guys happened to be in. But I think this team can get better on both ends of the floor. But what intrigues me so much is that they have these stretches when they're locked in defensively. And you just sit there and go, how the hell is anybody going to beat them?
Yeah, when Iguodala is at his best on the perimeter when Draymond and Durant are protecting the rim and providing weak side help. It's hard to believe that a team could score against them. And you see these snowballing runs that the Warriors put up, like we saw in the second quarter, where they just run teams out of the gym. The feedback loop analogy that you used is exactly right. Like, it just is a chain reaction that gets set off, and it's very hard for teams to defuse it.
I want to read a quote from LeBron. I actually was not in the interview room for his section. I was there for a lot of the Warriors guys, but I was actually in their locker room for that. But I thought this was really fascinating. So somebody asked LeBron about kind of where this is all going and everything like that. And Matt Moore used this really well in his piece for CBS, which I thought was excellent. So he said, I'm just going to read it. It's a couple sentences. Well, it's a two-sided question because for me personally, I don't know. I need to sit down and figure this thing out. So I don't know as far as me personally right now. But as far as that team, meaning the Warriors, they're going to be here for a while. They're going to be around for a while. Pretty much all their guys are in their 20s. Pretty much all their big game guys are in their 20s, and they don't show any signs of slowing down. So there's going to be a lot of teams that try to figure out ways to put personnel together to try to match that if they're able to actually face them in the playoff series, both Eastern and Western Conference. But they're built, from my eyes, they're built to last a few years, so we'll see. I've never heard anything like that from LeBron. That was a very different recognition of, oh crap. Like, and LeBron was spectacular in the series. He averaged a triple double, and that understates his impact. And you can't throw any shame, any blame on him for them losing the series 4-1. But he knows what they were up against in this series.
Yeah, that's LeBron confronting the idea that he has a team that's pretty much capped out. I think you're the cap expert here, but it doesn't seem to me like they're going to have much flexibility for a while. He recognizes physically that he's not able to go as long as he previously could, shouldering the entire load for the team. Think about 2 years ago in the NBA Finals, the LeBron that we saw late in the game, I feel like, was more dangerous than the LeBron we saw late in these finals games. And so he's confronting the thought that he's going to have to try to go through this team, the Warriors, for any championship that he's going to win for the rest of his career. And he doesn't have a pathway through that right now. So that has to be in the front of his mind of how do I avoid being in the same position next year? What changes? What can shift the power here?
And it is going to be hard for them, especially when you consider that the pathways for them to get better, one of them is they're going to have a mid-level exception that's going to cost Dan Gilbert a lot of money. He's presumably going to be willing to pay it. But the only real other way would be if they wanted to make a move involving Kyrie, unlikely. Kyrie was spectacular in this game. Or Kevin Love. And with Kevin Love, certainly a talented guy, has another couple of years under contract, but you are taking a lot to try to sell another team on getting him back. Like, there's been some speculation. I checked Reddit briefly, and people are like, oh, maybe something with Kevin Love for Paul George. Like, why is that going to be the package that Indiana wants for Paul George? It's not like he has a no-trade clause. Love is, you know, has another couple of years. He's not ready to be with their young guys. If they're trading Paul George, they're not going to be good right away. So for Cleveland to really take a step up, it's going to take good fortune. They can get there. They've had good fortune before, but it's hard. And that's why the Warriors are in this fascinating situation, especially if Durant takes a couple million less, where, yes, their team will be prohibitively expensive, but they can keep it together, and they're better right now than the Cavs are.
Yeah, and you look at some of the supporting cast that LeBron leaned on this year. Richard Jefferson's going to come back a year older next year. You know, he played 17 minutes. He was one of the big defensive pieces that the Cavs tried to use to slow down the Warriors. Korver's going to be older. Williams, you know, we don't even know if he's going to be on the team next year. It's going to be an interesting mix to see which veterans LeBron can try to bring in on minimum deals or the mid-level deals to try to round this out. Like you said, there are no easy fixes. And Kevin Love, he of a negative 23 in 30 minutes in game five, you know, 2 for 8 from the field for a total of 6 points. Yeah, I don't think NBA GMs are burning up the phone lines right now trying to find a way to separate Kevin Love from the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Love is certainly talented, and I think he has a place in the league, and he had some really nice moments in these playoffs, but it's hard because he's I think he's really close to properly paid, and he doesn't have that long under contract. So you're sitting there going, well, why are we going to treat him like a megastar when he's very good, but he is kind of what he is? And I don't really have more to say on that, but something I wanted to talk about with you, and this gets into a part of this that I don't usually talk about on this show, but there is something special about seeing a championship won, and in this time it was seeing a championship won at home. You and I have been lucky enough to see all three of these in person. And what was resonant for me in this one, and this seemed to be the case too with a lot of the holdover players, was seeing the guys who are winning for the first time. And this is a Warriors group that, yes, the core has, you know, a lot of the core has already won, you know, Draymond, Klay, and Steph most notably, and Iguodala. But not only Durant, David West, Matt Barnes, JaVale McGee, like those guys have been around for a while now, and to see them all win their first championship and the reaction that they had was something special.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I forget it, whether it was Draymond or someone else talked about how watching them and sort of the realization pass, you know, into their eyes of what was happening was in some ways more fun than actually winning it themselves, you know, for the people who had been there 2 years ago and won it. And I also think that not having experienced a championship on a home floor before, it is a different experience, obviously. In Cleveland, when the Warriors won the first time, they spent a good chunk of the ceremony getting booed by the Cleveland fans. You know, there was a small group of Warriors fans that had traveled for the game who cheered them on, but it wasn't really a celebration. It was sort of hostile territory. Let's get the award and let's get back into the locker room. Tonight was a party. You know, everybody was staying, enjoying it, savoring it. The floor was full. It was just a completely different vibe out there. And I think it had to be a fun contrast to the first time that the Warriors won it for the players who were on that team.
And there's nothing you can really do to change the, like, when it happens at home, but it certainly was a special experience. And to see the way that the building ebbed and flowed in this game was fascinating, because there was a lot of tension at a lot of moments in this, because they're the ghosts of not only game 7 but game 5 last year. The Warriors hadn't ever won a clinch game at home in the NBA finals. They never had. And so they had a lot to kind of work through in this, and Cleveland was a very game opponent. So to have all of those things run together was incredible.
Yeah, the four consecutive closeout games lost to Cleveland. Granted, a lot of extenuating circumstances, and you can sort of explain away each one of them, but that was looming over this. And I sort of felt a palpable sense of tension in the arena beforehand. I wouldn't describe it as fear necessarily, but there was an edge there. People were up for the game. They knew it was going to be a battle. And I think that was shared by the Warriors in the way that they ultimately played it, that they, you know, had the appropriate fear or whatever, you know, Popovich term you want to use for it. They knew what was at stake. They knew they couldn't give this team more life, and they found a way to play in a dominant fashion at the most important parts of the game.
You and I were sitting close to each other, but we didn't really interact during the game. What were you thinking about when J.R. Smith was hitting all those shots?
I kept on waiting for him to miss. He finally did with one of them later in the game, but then he hit a final one. JR, it's like you always expect, you know, one make to trigger two or three misses, but he just kept on making them.
And he was making these ridiculous shots. A stat I pulled when Nate and I were recording Dunked On that I just didn't know. So the final made shot of all four quarters in this game were J.R. Smith threes.
Wow.
That's wild for a guy who makes 9 shots. And I mean, he was 9 of 11, 7 of 8 from 3. But yeah, so he just, because he had that one at the end of the fourth quarter, and he's just such a maestro. And we always give LeBron and Kyrie credit for this, and we should, but he is amazing at making tough shots.
Yeah, it's a team of shot makers. You know, when you look at the difficulty of the shots that Kyrie, J.R. Smith, and LeBron made this series, it's just insane. You know, Kyrie had some of the most spectacular offensive stretches that I've seen from anyone in my years of being an NBA fan. He was that good at times. But it's still a flawed Cleveland team. They still have defensive holes. Their offense still falls apart at times when LeBron's not in the game. You know, we can go into whether they're coaching things that could be, you know, done that could make difference here, or whether it's a personnel issue more. But they're pieces that need to get fixed. But that shouldn't detract from the incredible talent that's on this Cleveland roster.
Something that I was thinking about during the festivities tonight was that this year's team has a very different concept of continuity compared to last year, because last year, even though we couldn't have expected everything to go the way that it did in terms of Durant, even if we might have had the idea that it was possible, Barnes was hitting free agency, Festus Ezeli, there was the stuff with Andrew Bogut, it was kind of pretty openly that openly looked like he might not be back. So you had that idea that the Warriors were going to look different as much as they had won 73 games in the regular season. So what I was thinking about during it was, okay, this year, it looks like a lot of the principals are going to be back. It does depend on Durant taking a little bit less money and then figuring out an agreement with at least Iguodala, maybe Iguodala and Livingston. But what I was sitting there thinking about was Pachulia, West, and JaVale. So yes, those guys are all going to have the opportunity to make more money somewhere else than they could make as the Warriors. But I got to see each one of them celebrating the championship, and I was just sitting there going, I wonder how many of these guys are going to decide that that's not, that leaving that is not worth the money that they would make.
Yeah, well, with Pachulia and West, it's easy because we already know that they were willing to give up bigger contracts to go have a chance at a ring. And now that they've been here and that they have a ring and they see what the environment's like, I would say that there's very strong chances that both of those guys consider returning. With JaVale, it's tougher because it wasn't clear that he was going to be able to get much more out on the open market than the Warriors offered him. He knows he's in a perfect situation here where the coaching staff works well with him. His teammates trust him and get the most out of him. But he's going to leave some money on the table. And he's a guy who's made some money, but not an insane fortune by NBA standards. He could make significantly more elsewhere. So he's the tough call. But I think that the point you made about the viewing consistency a different way is a good one, because last year's team, it was sort of inevitable that there were going to be major pieces that were going to fall away. This year, there's not that sense of inevitability. That there's more flexibility because of Durant's willingness, apparently, to take less money. And whether they are able to keep both Livingston and Iguodala or just Iguodala, it's a team that I think is rare once again, and that people are sacrificing money to keep something great together. It's impressive to see.
And they won't have a ton of flexibility outside of those bird rights, so I think that'll make it harder to keep some of them. But it's going to be a challenge for any other team, unless I think Boston's probably the team that can change this, to tell those guys who want to play for a ring next year, who think they want to have a good shot of winning a championship, to go somewhere else. Because if the Warriors keep all these guys together, and you know, Cleveland played, I thought after game one, they played about as well as you could reasonably expect in this series. And They won one of those games. They easily could have won a second. They got close in this one too. But you know, the Warriors still have the advantage there. And I think Cleveland is going to age more rapidly than the Warriors by and large. So If it becomes this kind of one opportunity for ring chasers, if the Warriors get into this fascinating situation where they might actually have to make some hard choices. And
yeah, they might have their pick.
They might have their pick. And I haven't gone through the full market yet to see who that's going to be, but I'm fascinated by that prospect of, you know, the idea that team players oftentimes they'll pick, you know, maybe among a few teams that they think have a good shot of winning a championship. And there always are some. I mean, you can optimistically make arguments for the Spurs and the Cavs and maybe the Celtics if they go for the win now approach. But if those players, whoever they are, whatever their pay range is, if they say, hey, I really want to play for the Warriors, probably for 1 year, then the Warriors have the power to say, hey, we'd like you, but we cannot pay you more than X. And so if they want to take it, they can take it. If they don't, then so be it.
Yeah, they may actually, you know, Bob Myers in all of his amazing tricks that he's pulled, he may have negotiating leverage against veterans who are looking to come to the Warriors to get a ring. And don't underestimate the ability of David West and JaVale McGee to be advertisements. You know, those are guys who, you know, different sort of ends of the spectrum. West is someone who is a proven commodity, who was able to find a place where his skills really blossomed and they could use different facets of his game. And JaVale was a guy who was on his way out, who really pulled his way back into the NBA and rebuilt his career here. There are tons of players that fit both of those categories who are going to look at the Warriors now and say, that could be me. I could go play into June. I could have this much fun. I could go extend my NBA career. And we'll see what Myers is able to do with it. Hopefully the Warriors are going to have some interesting choices to make.
And we'll also get to see maybe some of the young guys take a larger role. Patrick McCaw, we talked about him a little bit. I think that the setting is going to be right for him. My expectation is that Ian Clark will not be back, just because I think he's going to get too much money somewhere else, and the Warriors are going to think, yeah, that's good. Let him go there. Kings or whoever else. And McCaw can take a lot of that role. I think, depending on how many centers the Warriors can get, Damian Jones might be ready for maybe the third spot of those three. Or maybe he's kind of like one of the options for the third spot. And so we'll see that. And then they're going to have some other roster spots open, and they'll probably be beating guys. They'll be fighting guys off with a stick to see who can get them. And that's a great problem to have. And it's going to lead to a bunch of people whining about competitive balance again, but the Warriors don't need to worry about that. Doesn't matter to them.
Yeah. The Warriors are playing by the system. This is how the rules were created. And if other teams feel like it's unfair, well, that's for the next CBA. But it seems like the Warriors aren't exploiting a loophole here. They're just building a good culture and a winning basketball team, and people want to join it.
And really, I have focused earlier in my life on the idea of how the collective bargaining agreement, particularly the 2011 one, was unfairly biased towards major market teams, because the idea was that if those teams ever got good, that guys could take less money and they could get endorsement opportunities and all that sort of stuff. And what the Warriors are doing is, first of all, they're a bigger market than some people think. But secondly, they're showing that, especially when the major markets don't have their act together, which right now they don't, that you can get all these other spillover benefits. And think about, I didn't talk about this at all on Dunked On, the Warriors were, I think they were close to the middle in terms of total salary paid in the NBA this year. And they got one of the best teams in NBA history, one of the best seasons in NBA history. And yes, it's going to be ungodly expensive moving forward, but to be able to get those guys on the margins is really what helps make all this possible. Getting David West for the minimum, getting Zaza Pachulia for what was then a joke of the room mid-level exception, McCaw for the minimum, Matt Barnes for the minimum. Like, those moves worked out by and large and really helped make this team possible.
Yeah, you get that because the Bay Area is a good place to live. There are some other economic benefits that come with being in a market the Bay Area size and being near Silicon Valley. And I think that the atmosphere that the Warriors have created, that the reputation of being a player-friendly team can't be underestimated, that they're known now as a place like a San Antonio where you're going to have a high quality of people around you, where you really enjoy your time playing.
I'm not sure if you saw it, but I got a good chuckle out of Mo Spates tweeting out about LeBron's kick in game.
I did.
I think it was game 3, it was game 2. And I was just like, oh, look at that. Like, Mo Spates still sticking up for his guys. And then, you know, he's another ambassador too, even though he didn't get paid a ton of money. But, you know, he helped revitalize his reputation, his career as a part of the 2015 title team.
Yeah, and what Mo opted out from his Clippers deal, right? So Mo may want back on the Warriors. He may be one of those guys coming and lobbying them for a position again.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. But instead of looking forward to next year, let's talk a little bit about the year that just passed. And I was thinking about it today, even though sitting in a very different seat, that Klay's 60-point game was this season.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. It feels like there's been so much that's happened this season. All the expectations that went with this team. Kevin Durant mentioned the Vancouver preseason game where this team first appeared together. That feels like 3 seasons ago to me. It just feels like ages ago.
And then the Memphis game after Christmas, when they fell apart again in crunch time and people were like, oh, what's wrong with the Warriors? And that was what helped kind of finalize, and the meltdown against Sacramento. And then you have all that and it's like, oh yeah, that was about 5 months ago.
Yeah, the game that stands above all others this season to me is the Christmas game when they lost in Cleveland, because I think that that's the game that really forced Curry and Durant to figure out how they were going to make this work. It's crazy that the adversity that this team faced was that the 2-time MVP was being too selfless and not being assertive enough, but that really was kind of the mystery at the beginning of the season, and they needed to work on it. And I don't think it fully clicked until after Durant came back from his injury, when Curry had kind of had a chance to get his mojo back, to get back into the flow of being the man with the ball in his hands. And that's when they were both really able to assert themselves and find a competitive balance where they would get the touches that they wanted and that they needed and that were good for the team.
That ties in with what I think is one of the more remarkable parts of this season's story. And I make the joke a lot about light years and on all that sort of stuff, but part of the idea of last year was, oh, the Warriors, yeah, they had this devastating collapse, and that might have been part of the reason they got Kevin Durant. And now they've already won one title with Kevin Durant. So for fans who want to engage in that hypothetical of would you rather not have the 3-1 jokes and not have Kevin Durant, I'm not saying that was the choice, but theoretically, if it were, you can think about that and discuss it amongst yourselves. You can send me emails if you want, but I really don't care. But then you have that, and then you have some of the weird stuff that happened this year. So the Christmas Day game, you had Durant's injury, you had Steve Kerr missing time in the playoffs, surprisingly. And I think you can make an argument that the Warriors came out for better in all of those circumstances. The Christmas Day game forced them to reevaluate the way they were approaching the Curry-Durant dynamic. Durant being out was part of what helped Steph Curry find his place offensively. And then Kerr was kind of gave them another lean towards, okay, this is what it's going to look like if we ever have to rely heavily on our best guys. And so I think those were real pieces of adversity, and they could have derailed the team. They could have led to negative issues, but I think each one of them ended up making them stronger, and that's surprising and impressive.
Yeah, it's absolutely impressive. It's a testament to the basketball IQ of this team that when they're faced with a problem, they come up with a solution. They sort of apply their collective basketball intelligence to work through it. The cumulative result of that is that when they get around the problem, they're better for it. They see more, they understand more of the game, they have more versatility, they have better balance. And that really played out. The Warriors were playing their best basketball in the final rounds of the playoffs this year. It was the cumulative effort of an entire season of learning on their part.
So I think we're pretty close to the end of this conversation. I don't even really know how to kind of to end this, but like, if you were to it's hard to do now because we're still in the moment. We're still in the afterglow of a second championship in 3 years. But what do you think when we, as old men years from now, will think back about this year? What do you think we'll remember most?
It's a good question. It's a hard question. I think that the singular talent of Curry and Durant is always going to be vivid in our memories. They're just such special, unique players that I think that they're going to transcend kind of the history of the individual teams that they play on. Durant, because of his size and his skill, Curry, because of just his artistry with the ball and his shooting. So those guys are always going to stand out. But for me personally, I would like to think that just the collective joy of this team is something that becomes a part of their reputation. They are guys who all sacrificed. They were all willing to take, less fame, less involvement on the floor and what was going on to succeed and to do something great historically themselves. And they accomplished it. So personally, I would like to see this team remembered for their willingness to put aside their egos and their individual careers and really collectively come together to do something amazing, something that almost hadn't been done before in the NBA, which was to go 16-0 in the playoffs. And they only tied the record instead of beat it, which is still pretty good in my book.
I agree with all that. And I want to isolate it on a single person. That's Kevin Wayne Durant. I think back a lot to that series last year, the Western Conference Finals. I was lucky enough to get to cover all but one of those games. The only game I missed was Game 6, which in many ways is one of the other more important games in the arc of the NBA. But Durant had a wonderful place on that Thunder team. And when they figured it out defensively, as they did against the Spurs and against the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals, they were a force. They were a force to be reckoned with. But Durant, to me, looked so much more at home on this team. And that is not meant as a dig on Russell Westbrook. I love Russell Westbrook. I knew him in college. I would have voted for him for MVP if the NBA gave me a vote. But this team was Kevin Durant's speed. And it's amazing that that all happened, because you think about the idea that was so different with Durant to the Warriors from LeBron joining the Heat, where those guys had a pre-existing relationship. They were coming into something that didn't exist before them. Kevin Durant joined a team with 73 that had won 73 games the year before, that had won a championship the year before that, that had three bona fide all-stars that were there. They had an MVP who hadn't turned 30 yet, a two-time MVP, unanimous MVP. He came in, and it certainly appeared to me that he got everything he wanted. And that might be end up being the best sales pitch that the Warriors could have too. And you know, when a guy takes a big jump like that, whatever it is, whether it's Durant in this case, or, you know, somebody in another sport or somebody in their own personal life, you want it to work out for them. And I'm amazed that it worked out as seamlessly as it did.
Yeah, me too. And it's amazing just how obvious it is that how in the happiness that Durant's feeling. And you and I think we're both in the room for his post-game press conference. He just looks like somebody who is completely at peace and who has really kind of found himself and come into his own. And it's great to watch someone who is so skilled at what they do operate from such a place of confidence and kind of mental peace.
And while it's not locked in stone, it looks like we'll probably get to see it for another few years to come. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, always great to be on, particularly after the Warriors win a championship.
Thanks again to Adam Wardson for taking the time to come on. You can read him at Fast Break, the Barrier News Group's Warriors fan blog, and you can also follow him on Twitter at GSW Fast Break. It is surreal to not only experience the team you cover winning a championship, to see it for the second time, and to talk about it it's been a thrill. It absolutely has been. And it's wild to end this season also, you know, long night, recording this at 3:15 in the morning, with it being my last episode of Locked On Warriors. And as I've talked about when I did the kind of goodbye before, this A is not goodbye forever in any way, shape, or form. I just am not sure exactly what I want to do next year for podcasting, and did not want to leave David Locke and the great Locked On Podcast Network in a lurch. So I'm handing the show off in the very capable hands of Drew Schiller and Grant Lifman. Excited to see what they do with this. They're very excited for the opportunity, and I'm thrilled to have it in good hands and that the listeners of the show will not be missing out, because in terms of my Warrior specific podcasting, I probably will be taking some time off. I'm guessing, you know, we'll cover it plenty in Dunked On and in Real Jam Radio, but I don't think it's going to come back anytime in the near future. So probably maybe October, November, or something like that, probably around when the book comes out, but maybe a little bit before that. So you'll be able to hear my voice in those other places and see my writing plenty. Stopping doing this also is opening the door to get more writing done. So be working with The Athletic probably at least through the end of this month, hopefully much, much longer than that. Then for SI, my off-season preview for the Warriors is going to come out soon. I'm actually going to write the finishing touches on that after this. And then other work for Real GM, other work for the Sporting News. And of course, a lot of that ends up touching the Warriors because they are in many ways the linchpin for the league right now. And back in, I think it was July, when I talked with David Locke about doing Locked On Warriors and was thrilled that he thought of me, a lot of it for me was the idea that it was an experience that I wanted to have, and I knew that this was going to be a team that was going to be worth that. I wasn't sure if it was going to be worth that because they were going to win a championship or because they were going to be interesting. There is a long history in the NBA of high-profile additions not working out, and that's kind of what I was getting at a little bit with Adam at the end, was the idea that this really did work out swimmingly, and it has been so much fun to be able not only to provide this kind of content, but to be able to have it with such an enthusiastic and supportive fan base. I couldn't have asked for anything more. And both from things like Reddit mailbags or email questions that I get or Twitter comments or everything like that, it has been so much fun to experience this and to connect with all of you and hopefully make your commutes, make your days better. My hope was always that I could provide a different voice in this. I am very cognizant and always have been of the amazing people who share the Bay Area sports media in particular landscape, and that's now true for podcasting, just as true as it is everywhere else. Giants like Tim Kawakami, Marcus Thompson, who were there before I started, and who knows, will probably be there after I move on to whatever my next thing is. They do incredible work. Slater is doing great work at Bay Area News Group as well. I could go through so many other people as writers, as podcasters, and my hope was always to do something a little bit different, and that I knew was not going to necessarily be the most broad thing. I come at this from a very different perspective as somebody who considers themselves more of an analyst than a fan or a partisan, even though I did grow up in the Bay Area. That's not who I am. And my goal with this was always to take that approach and see if it worked. And I am not the one who can make that determination. I'm not sure any single person can, but that is why the positive response has been so heartening for me, is the idea that I did this the way I wanted to do it. And those of you who stuck with it, that you got something out of it. And that's all I can ever ask. I can never ask for everybody to like everything that I do. That is impossible. And so what I've decided over the years is to do what I do and know that some people will be along for the ride and some people will not. And the joy of doing it with the Warriors is that I feel fully confident that the people who do not enjoy this have other places to be. There are lots of other great podcasts, lots of other great writers, and they can go there. And I'm thankful to each and every one of you, individually and collectively, for enjoying what I do, for better or for worse. And it has been so much fun to change my own skill set, to try new things. The idea of doing a podcast of even 10 minutes by myself was daunting. I wouldn't say it was giving me sleepless nights, but I was definitely concerned and cognizant of it. And now that is not something I can do at all. I mean, crap, this monologue is going to be probably close to 8 or 9 minutes. And that has been so much fun and so important in terms of building confidence for me as a more versatile person in that way. And I'm thankful that you guys have come along for the ride. And yes, a lot of the most listened to episodes in this run are those interviews. I mean, the one I did with Marcus Thompson, the game analysis pieces and everything like that. But I derive a lot of satisfaction from things like the one on the West playoff opponents, from all the stuff related to the Cap with Durant and everything else, and the idea of trying to take concepts that I have in my years of covering the team since 09, focused on the medium of writing, and said, how can I make this a podcast? How can I make this listenable? How can I make this something that somebody would A, grasp the main points, and B, would actually be enjoyable? And your enjoyment may vary. That's something very different. But it has been so much fun to try to do that intellectually for me. And then it's thrilling to succeed. It's disappointing to fail, but all the while knowing that it's your thing and that it's your try. And it's been just a joy to be able to put that together, and a joy to be able to do that with this team that A, provided so much material, but also a lot of really good basketball. And those of you who know me in other contexts know that I do watch a lot of bad basketball too, including back when that was the Warriors. And there is an intense satisfaction to watching the best in the world do what they do, and to be able to appreciate it for what it is, and also be able to analyze it honestly and with clear eyes and an open heart, because that is important as well. And, you know, I spent a lot of this podcast, you know, at moments criticizing Steve Kerr, including after Game 4. And seeing a lot of those things come into play in Game 5 was personally satisfying. You never know, and I'm not saying, I was right or anything like that, but it is nice to see kind of some of that stuff just come a little bit first full circle, so you don't have to wonder in the same type of way. And so it was satisfying in that way, and I got a lot of comments over the course of tonight from people saying, like, oh, you must be so happy and everything like that, related to Kerr, you know, going small and everything like that. And yeah, certainly I was. And that doesn't always happen. It usually doesn't. I think back to when I was a kid, I had a running joke that the Niners never took the guy I wanted in the draft because I was a big draft guy then. And so I kind of feel like that's the way these kind of things usually work out. So to have it at this point, especially, you know, tying in with the last episode of Locked On Warriors, was great. It was thrilling. And the most important thing that I can convey beyond appreciation, just in a broader sense, is just how thankful I am to David Locke for providing the opportunity, to my guests for taking the time to come on. There is a reason why I always use that phrasing, because the people who I think are worth having on this show are all people who have a lot going on. Adam has a day job, you know, Tim Bontemps, Kevin Pelton, Ben Golliver, Nate when he comes on, everybody, they all have a lot to do. And I was never giving them money or any sort of opportunity to die. That's just not the way this business works. And so I am so appreciative of them for taking the time. And on those same lines, I'm appreciative to all of you for taking the time to listen, because you have many other options, and spreading the word as you have, and telling people, hey, if this is what you're looking, if this is what you like, to give this a listen. And it's been exciting to grow over the course of it. It also helps when the team just keeps on going in the playoffs. But I appreciate all of you for that. And I hope that you follow Locked On Warriors as Drew and Grant take it over. And I hope they do great things. And I hope that you follow me in what I do, writing, podcasting, when that comes back, and everything else. So thank you so much for taking the time, for letting me into your life, because really that's what this is. And I can never repay you for that. All I can say is thank you. So thank you, take care, and make it a great day.